welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. My guest this week from his office in Crawfordsville is Mayor Todd Barton. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for being with us. If you've got a question for Mayor Barton during our next half hour, please give us a call. That number is 496-1999. You can also send emails to ask@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions to @WBAAnews on Twitter. Well, I want to start actually by going back to last month's show. You were not optimistic about the future of Amtrak service, in part because several cities along the line, it appeared, did not intend to pay to keep that going. But in that time, in the intervening month between last show and this one, both Indianapolis and Beech Grove, whom you kind of chastised a little bit on the show, have agreed to pay at least through the end of January. To what do you attribute that turnaround?
Well, I think there's been a, I know there's been a lot of work behind the scenes, and we've done a lot of reaching out, and there's been a lot of communication, you know, and not just directly between cities, but also, you know, trying to inform, I think, the public in those cities, you know, so that they might step up, those in favor of passenger rail within those communities, those constituencies could step up and speak to their elected officials. So it's kind of been a, I'd say a full court press, but we did really work very hard in the last month to really make some things happen. And, you know, the pressing issue is that once it goes away, it's unlikely to come back. So we want to continue to buy ourselves some time to kind of make this right and not make a quick decision that we might regret for decades.
Not to toot our own horn here, but I know that the comments you made on this show got some distribution outside of just our listening area. Did anyone come back to you and say, hey, Barton, why are you rapping us on the knuckles like this?
No one said that directly, but I think we got some attention, that's for sure.
So now the line will keep running at least until the legislative session is underway at the beginning of next year. And you also said last month that the state needs to help fund the line and you wanted the governor to be a more direct player in this process. I wonder if you think it's more likely now that legislators will at least be meeting as the next service termination deadline approaches, that this has a better chance of getting some state funding.
I think it does have a better chance at this point. You know, I think all along that this had kind of taken a side burner and was not getting a lot of attention, but as the deadlines have loomed, as this has become more of a crisis situation, more and more people have stepped up. And I think it really comes down for the legislators and the governor and all elected officials. You know, they really base a lot of times their decisions on what they're hearing, and they weren't hearing a lot of positive pro-passenger rail support out there. As they're seeing more and more of that support, they're more willing to step up and make some things happen.
One of the things we did not mention, but I think plays into this discussion that we did not mention last month, is that the head of the House Ways and Means Committee, which, of course, writes the budget, is Tim Brown, who's from your area. Have you talked with him about this at all?
Absolutely. Dr. Brown and I had a discussion earlier this week. We didn't get much into passenger rail. We kind of touched on it. But we'll have more discussions coming up, and he knows it's important to our community. Obviously, he lives here and works here, so you know, I'm not going to step out and say he's going to be right there for us, but we've at least had some discussions, and I know he's listening to us.
What do you get the sense his opinion is? What kinds of things is he weighing on this topic?
You know, I don't have a strong committal from Dr. Brown one way or the other on this yet, other than he knows it's important, and he knows it has to be considered as part of the big picture.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting this afternoon with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. We'd love to have your phone calls. The number to call us is area code 765-496-1999. You can also tweet your question to @WBAAnews. That's all one word on Twitter. Earlier this week, you referenced Lafayette as your city moved toward putting a bunch of its economic development organizations into one place, into the same building. This is something that's been done in a number of places, and now your city is on its way to doing that. What finally caused that to happen?
Well, this is something that's been in the works for quite some time. You know, when I ran for office, I felt like those agencies needed to start to come together, and my biggest challenge is harnessing the power and the energy that's out there among all these agencies and groups and individuals that are trying to make good things happen. And, you know, this was the next logical step in that process. So it's been in the making for a few years. Really the thing that's tipped the balance is that the city of Crawfordsville and Wabash College jointly applied for a grant through the Lilly Foundation to focus on keeping our college graduates here in Indiana, keeping them in our community. And we were awarded that grant, and we are going to operate a joint center for community development. So that serves as a catalyst to tie our community agencies in with that center under one roof in one spot.
Did the city have much of an economic development presence in the past? I know there are some cities that have their own, sometimes extra governmental entities that serve to foster economic development. What has Crawfordsville's historic position been on trying to get investment through some sort of city agency?
Well, the city of Crawfordsville and Montgomery County follow a model that's very similar to the state in that we have a quasi-government agency, Montgomery County Economic Development Incorporated, that was created so that it could move swiftly and respond to requests and be nimble. That's been in place for many years, and so that is funded jointly by the city, the county, and then private donations. We really took a hard look at that a couple of years ago and really kind of started over and created a new plan for economic development, and we have a new director on board. And so we've really been very aggressive in that, and we're really starting to see that pay dividends because the plan we created was created with local talent, and it was based on our situation. It wasn't a template from someone else. So MCED, as we refer to them, is carrying that plan out, and we're making constant adjustments in that process. So it's a joint city-county funded operation that operates as a private entity, very similar to IEDC on the state level.
How does that organization balance the needs of your city, which is, of course, the largest municipality in Montgomery County, with the needs of the larger county as a whole and all of the outlying areas, especially the smaller communities in the county?
Right. We have a joint board that's set up, and so we have representation from the city and the county on that board, and we guide really the policy and the direction of that organization. So we both have equal input, and the situation that exists right now in our community between the city and the county is very, very good, and we cooperate and we work hand in hand to make things happen because we've come to realize that we have to work together to move the entire community forward. But what we tend to see in the economic development front is that we're really not in competition because we have areas that we want to develop. The county has areas that they can develop, and they really target different kinds of businesses and industries. So when you're talking the heavy industry, steel processing, we know that needs to be shifted off to the counties, to the new core corridor in that area. Some of the other things are lighter that need to focus more in the city and our commerce park. So we've not had any issues with that.
I wonder what you think some of the benefits are of having all of these people in one area, apart from just the cost savings of not having to rent several spaces within a number of different buildings. I also wonder, at the same time, were you seeing that there was a duplication of effort among some of these agencies, that people were going after the same ideas or after the
Absolutely.
Same donors that
Yeah.
you hope to curtail?
Absolutely. Communication, I think, is the first thing we are after. And you know, like I noted earlier, the first thing that I really come to realize is that we had so many groups out there and really trying to do good things and really working hard, but they weren't communicating. And so there was a lot of duplication of effort. Sometimes, you know, might step on one another's toes a little bit and feelings get hurt. And then there were areas that we were just totally missing, that things were not happening because someone else, you know, everyone assumed that someone else was doing it. So one thing we did is a couple of times now, and we just did it last, I believe it was February, we pulled all of these entities that are trying to make good things happen in our community together in one place at one time. We went around the table and just put up on the wall everything that they were working on. For me, it wasn't shocking because I touch on all these entities every day in my job, but for them to see what everyone else was doing was a shock because there was so much going on. And there really needs to be a lot of coordination. So we feel like if we just put everybody together and co-locate, that we will improve that communication and cooperation dramatically.
What kinds of things weren't getting done? What were some of the things that everybody else thought that the other entities were doing that, in fact, weren't getting done at all?
Well, there were a lot of housing issues that we didn't feel like were getting addressed. There was a lot of focus on economic development. But some of the areas, like I said, housing and some of those gaps that come in between some of those issues were nobody really had the lead. And so a lot of times we tried to figure out who should have the lead in this area because you know, you can try to develop jobs in a community and want to attract people to your community, but if no one's really trying to figure out where those people are going to live and you know, that kind of stuff, when they get here, you had a big gap. So that's one of the things that stood out to me, that nobody was really addressing that. So we're kind of, we had more of an overlap than we had missing things, for sure.
I wonder if you see any future of consolidation here. Now you've got several entities that will all be sharing a space.
Right.
They each have a similar aim for their own organization. But at the same time, it seems to me that the money that they could all raise could be seen in various ways to stay with their individual groups. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce is not necessarily the same thing as the county. Is there any
Right.
thought in your mind that these entities might combine into a larger entity, hoping that the sum will be greater than its individual parts?
I think that's a very real possibility down the road. And you know, this week I pointed to the model that you have in Lafayette, West Lafayette, Tippecanoe County, with the Greater Lafayette Chamber of Commerce. It's an interesting model, and it seems to work very well. I mean, you really can't argue with the success that they've had. And they've combined all these entities together under one umbrella organization. I'm not sure that we really are to the point that we could handle putting all these organizations immediately together, but I think co-location is the first step in exploring that and moving down that pathway. So I'm optimistic that we'll see some mergers down the road. I don't think we're quite ready there, or quite ready for that to happen just yet, though.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. If you'd like to join us today by calling in with a question, you can do so at 496-1999. In fact, we do have our first phone caller of the afternoon. Liz is calling in from Lafayette. Good afternoon, Liz. Thanks for calling in to Ask the Mayor.
Well, certainly. And Mayor Burton, I want to kind of cycle back to your first topic, although there is a connection. You mentioned at the very beginning of your discussion about consolidating economic development entities, about keeping the best and brightest college students in our area and in our state and so forth, and passive transportation has been shown so often to be important to this upcoming generation. And with that in mind, if you could wave your wand and have the best possible outcome for what happens after January 1st with the Hoosier State, what would that be? What kind of, obviously that's a service that needs improvement. What, you know, how do, there's a new contract in negotiation. What do you see as the best possible way forward in the next 1 to 5 years for that passenger rail service? What features and best future?
Mr. Mayor?
Yes.
I don't know if you heard Liz's question or not.
No, I could not hear her.
Sorry, she was wondering what the best case scenario for the Hoosier State Line was over the next 1 to 5 years, if you had to take a look at it.
Well, I don't know that I have the crystal ball or that I have all the information, but obviously for me, I would like to see us you know, really maintain this once a day, you know, in each direction route, and improve the service to make it more reliable. So, you know, let's change the time that it comes through to make it more acceptable, and let's speed it up, let's get it faster, let's improve the reliability by working with the freight railroads, and really improve the service. Because what we've seen in other states is, as you improve that reliability and the quality level, ridership goes up and it becomes more self-sufficient. Looking down the track, I guess, pun intended, once you do that, I think then you can start adding more service per day. So maybe you get to two times per day and things like that. But NDOT laid out a pretty nice plan for how we could progress and do that. We just have to, you know, get the Hoosier State, that first route, shored up and cleaned up first.
Liz, thanks for your question. We certainly appreciate it. If you've got a question, again, the phone number 496-1999, and you can tweet those questions to @WBAANews on Twitter. I wanted to pivot to a different topic. Earlier this year, the Crawfordsville School Board changed its policies, as did a number of school boards around the state, regarding what staff members could carry weapons on school grounds. I wonder what your feelings are on how they ended up proceeding.
You know, I'm not real familiar with what the Crawfordsville School Board's policy is. You know, I'm not sure that they're really allowing staff members to have weapons in the school, I believe, possibly in their vehicles. But other than that, I'm not really sure.
it seems like they were at least considering, and it's unclear to me whether this has happened or not, at least considering the superintendent or some other organizational member to say if Administrator X has training enough to be able to carry a firearm safely, that they would consider allowing that. And I wondered philosophically your feeling on that. This is something White County has done, for instance. They've gone as far as saying, you know, we're going to push ahead with this because we feel it's a school safety measure. What is your general feeling on it?
Well, you know, I think as long as we know that it's very tightly regulated and that anybody who's going to be carrying that firearm is very well trained and has taken the steps to make sure they can secure that and keep it secure, you know, that an accident is extremely unlikely to happen, it possibly could be a pretty strong deterrent to anyone thinking that they might walk into a school and wreak havoc. So there has to be a lot of balance involved in that, a lot of training, a lot of education, a lot of safety precautions. But, you know, I guess I'm not really opposed to saying that we're going to have the potential that, you know, someone who might do harm can know that there could be an armed person in the building who's trained and ready to defend our students. I like the scenario, obviously, much better in which we put trained police officers in our buildings, and we've been successful in doing that in Crawfordsville. I'm not going to say there's an officer in every building all the time. There's not. But, you know, the city and the school corporation work together and have obtained a grant to fund an officer who rotates among the buildings, and he's in the buildings, different buildings at various times. So we have a little bit of a deterrent there and know we have a well-trained officer in the building.
Is there a difference between finding more money for more school resource officers like that and training administrators or indeed sometimes staff members has been proposed? I mean, does one of those make more sense than the other as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously there's probably a big dollar difference between just training the existing people in the building and putting, you know, fully trained, equipped officers in the building. You know, I think the school corporation has to make a decision on this piece with administrators and employees. But from the city's perspective, as far as officers, you know, we've added officers. We've nearly doubled the number of officers we have on the street at any given time in our community just in the last couple of years. And we did that by hiring additional officers and by changing our staffing shift requirements. So we went from 8-hour shifts to 12-hour shifts, and it's worked well for the officers, and it's worked well for the community. We will continue to explore how we might put more officers in the schools, and I know, you know, our chief's kind of looking at those issues right now. So I obviously lean that way. I would rather have officers in the school because there are a lot of situations that occur in a school that, thank goodness, don't require intervention with a firearm. And having a police officer there who can intervene in those situations and deter situations from occurring, I think prevents us from ever getting down that path to where something really tragic is happening and a firearm's needed.
You mentioned a couple of times there the idea of deterrence, and I got to thinking about that because that, of course, is an argument that's made a lot. And I wondered if deterrence doesn't hinge on the idea of both sides being rational actors. Of course, you could say that the school resource officers are never, ever going to draw their weapons unless it's a dire situation. But mm-hmm. I don't know that you can make the argument that someone who walks into a school with the intention of doing harm
right.
is a rational actor. And if they're not, it would seem hard to argue that they could be deterred by having more people with guns on school property.
Right. Well, I think all the research shows that most of the time when somebody does something like that, they think through that ahead of time. Now, these are not crimes of passion, usually. These are thought-out, planned attacks. I'm not saying they're rational, but they are thought out, and there is some planning that occurs. And you know, the seed has to be planted a long time before, you know, as the student's walking through school thinking, you know, I could just do whatever and nobody would stop me here. If we have that deterrent and they don't know when an officer will be in the building and not in the building and know that they can't just come in and carry out their evil plan without possible intervention, I think it is a deterrent. And I think having officers in the building is a deterrent because it really stops that thought process before a lot of these schemes are ever really hatched and take root. So, you know, obviously the crime of passion where someone just, you know, reacts to something, they're irrational and there's really nothing you're going to do to prevent that from starting. But I think, you know, if you really look at the research, a lot of these things are planned and thought out.
I also wondered, as I was pondering this morning, if this wasn't a little bit like what Anton Chekhov wrote about writing. And he basically says, you know, if in the first chapter of a story there's a gun, in the third chapter it had better go off. And he says if it's not going to be fired, the gun shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that sort of holds true in life, too. I mean, isn't it only a matter of time before introducing more guns in any way to schools means more rounds are fired from those guns?
It is a concern. Obviously, it's a concern, and I say that's why I lean more towards putting officers, putting trained, equipped officers in those positions if we can do that. Because, you know, an officer may go through a 20, 30, 40-year career and never fire their firearm in the line of duty. They're trained, they're equipped, they're prepared, but they by no means feel compelled that they need to use that because they carry it every day.
Is there a difference in your mind in terms of having, say, tasers given to school resource officers or staff at schools versus giving actual firearms to them? I mean, would it be a better solution and maybe a decent halfway point to give stun guns instead of pistols?
Well, you know, every situation is different, and there are a lot of tactical considerations there, and I in some situations that might be sufficient and that might work, and others that's not going to be. And I think we have to concentrate on really going back to the basics and you know, let's put officers in there. Let's try to really educate our children and focus on those things. And we have to look at this as a society. This is what we see happening in the schools is only reflective of what's happening in society as a whole. So I think we have a lot of unanswered questions, and there are no easy answers in this. There really aren't.
Of course, the other option would be installing more metal detectors or giving metal detecting
right.
wands to people within the schools. That, of course, is going to cost more, I would think, but it would seem like that's another option that's on the table but doesn't get talked about quite as much.
No, I don't think it does, and I think everyone is really leery. They don't want to create a situation in which our students feel like they're walking into an airport when they go to school, or they're walking into a prison when they go to school. We respect our freedoms, and we respect, those kind of things, and we want to maintain that as much as possible while offsetting those who might wish to do harm. So there's a balancing point there that's kind of tough to define sometimes. It really is.
We have just a couple minutes left with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton today on Ask the Mayor here on WBAA. You can call in your questions quickly if you like at 496-1999. While we're on the subject of metal detectors, I was in town a couple of months ago and I was talking with County Commissioner Phil Bain about the improvements that are slated to be made to the county courthouse. And frankly, your courthouse has the same problem that a lot of courthouses in Indiana do. Greencastle's is the same way. You're not terribly safe when it comes to limiting access and checking people for dangerous materials. You guys, of course, are on your way to working on that. But why do you think it took so long to get those appropriate fixes to be put in place and then utilized?
Well, I think probably a couple of factors, one being money. As money's tight and everyone, you have to make priorities and decide where you're going to put your resources and not. So that has been an issue for a long time with the county government. And I think secondary is just taking the problem seriously. There is that perception that this is a small town, and yes, bad things happen in other places, but will it really happen here? A couple of months ago, the commissioners were considering this issue, and Judge David Ault, I think, made a brilliant presentation to them and in which he spelled out incidents that have happened right here in Montgomery County in our courthouse, and he dumped out a box full of weapons that had been taken off of people inside our courthouse. So I think it started to hit home with them at that point and realized that, we do have to take this seriously here in our small community as well.
It seems like that might be part of a larger discussion that should be had among communities your size, because, of course, I would say your courthouse square, and indeed your community are like a whole lot of county seats in Indiana. And, we are not so far removed from what happened in Kokomo in 1987 to remember that bad things can happen catastrophically.
Absolutely.
At courthouses.
Absolutely. Yes, we're all very similar, and these things can happen, and really all it takes is one person to be upset and to make some really poor choices and do harm to others.
One more topic here in just our last couple of minutes. There, of course, has been construction on US 231 for some time now, especially on the stretch of road heading north out of downtown. And that, I think, it looks to me as I drive through, is hopefully nearing completion there. What do you think it's going to mean to the city when that all gets finished?
Well, we hope it's nearing completion. It's been a while, but, you know, they've resurfaced the bridge on 231 North over Sugar Creek, and that's kind of a lengthy process because they have to detour traffic at times and keep traffic away at times to keep the bridge stable. You know, these things, as they've worked on those, they've put new signals through our city, NDOT has, and some of those things. So it's all going to come together to really fit with what we're after. And I tell everyone that downtown Crawfordsville will look a lot different in two or three more years than it looks today because we have a lot of big projects in the works. We're getting ready to start a downtown master planning process. The old hospital project is moving forward. We met on that yesterday, and that's moving full steam ahead. That will be developed. We are getting closer to a development in the old Ben Hur building that's been vacant for many, many years. So a lot of things are happening in the downtown, and these NDOT projects just kind of fit with that to help move traffic through the area and make it look nicer.
It sounds like what you're saying is you're waiting on a synergy of all of these things to have a completion, and when they all do finally come to fruition on their individual timelines, you will have an additive effect among all of these things that makes
Absolutely.
Crawfordsville more appealing, especially
Absolutely.
Its downtown than it is now.
Absolutely. That's really what we're after, and you know, we talk about economic development, and we can all talk about the technical things such as tax abatement and how we approach it and those kind of things, but no one really wants to talk about the quality of life issue, and that is paramount to economic development. At the end of the day, we can all compete on tax abatement and whatever, but at the end of the day, people have to want to come to your community. They have to want to live in your community, and we need those people. We need those young families coming in and living here and buying things here and starting families here to move our community forward. But we have to offer the things that they want. So we spend a lot of time talking about connectivity and trails and quality of life and improving our downtown and those kind of things. You know, obviously, the hardcore stuff is still out there. We have to take care of infrastructure and we have to, you know, do all those things. But we have to improve quality of life. And we spent a lot of time and resources in the last 2 years cleaning things up. Tearing down old, dilapidated houses that were falling in, and we had a dilapidated factory that we took down and cleaned up. And so we really have to clean things up, spruce it up, make it a quality place, an attractive place to live.
Well, we will, I'm sure, talk about those things in the coming months, but we're out of time for this week. Mr. Mayor, we'll talk to you again in September.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
This has been Ask Mayor on WBAA. Join us next week for our conversation with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. Until then, you can find archived broadcasts on our website, wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a nice day.